This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. City mayors from around the country are in Honolulu for the annual U.S. Conference of Mayors, which ends today. Among the many issues facing communities across the country, what to do about the census and the effort by President Donald Trump to delay the count because of last week's Supreme Court decision. HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us in studio with more. Morning.
Morning, Catherine. Yeah, as you mentioned, mayors from around the country were in town this weekend. They were covering a wide variety of issues. A lot of it focused on climate change and decarbonization. But there were some other more specific issues. One of them was this big citizenship question on the census. And to give everybody a little bit of background on that issue, it started back in 2018 when the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross approved the addition of the following question on the 2020 U.S. Census. Is this person a citizen of the United States? And the U.S. Constitution mandates that every person living in the United States be counted every 10 years, what we call the census. And that responsibility falls to the Census Bureau, which is part of the Commerce Department. So Secretary Ross has a lot of sway over that process. There has not been a citizenship question on the census since 1950, and it had been removed after that. Opponents of adding that kind of question argued that it would cause non-citizens to avoid being counted, to not answer the census questionnaire for fear of legal action being taken against them. And we should say that by law, data collected by the Census Bureau can't be used for any kind of law enforcement purpose. It's kept strictly confidential, and they say on their website that they would never turn it over to any kind of law enforcement agency or immigration agency. But if people don't respond to the questions or when a census worker comes and knocks on your door, they may not be counted. And that's a big deal because the most important thing the census does is set the number of seats in the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives, that each state gets. That's based on population. And it's also important for federal programs and state programs, too, for distributing funds and social programs, that kind of thing. And so because of all of these concerns, big city mayors from around the country have been some of the most vocal opponents to this proposal. Cities tend to be, they tend to attract larger populations of immigrants. There are a lot of immigrants in cities around the country, no matter what region they're in. And so those cities and their leaders, their mayors, were worried that they would stand to lose out if their residents were undercounted, both in terms of congressional representation and potentially in terms of federal funding. So a coalition of 18 states and 16 local governments had opposed this question legally. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And on a 5-4 split, Chief Justice John Roberts was the swing vote. They blocked the addition of the question, at least temporarily. So they said that the Trump administration's justification for the question was not sufficient to warrant adding it. At the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Honolulu over this weekend, yesterday, a panel was convened of mayors and some legal representatives to discuss the census issue. And this was scheduled before the decision was made in anticipation of the decision being made. So they didn't really know what they were going to be discussing, whether it was going to be the question being there or being not there.
It was very timely.
Yeah, and I think there was a deadline for the Supreme Court, so I think they scheduled that with that decision in mind. Here's what a few of them had to say. Steve Benjamin is the mayor of Columbia, South Carolina, and he's the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which as a whole, as a body, opposed the census question. And Mayor Benjamin said, quote, "The nation's mayors are greatly encouraged by the Supreme Court's decision. Mayors, both Republican and Democrat, believe that such a question will jeopardize a full, fair, and accurate count and undermine the very core of the constitutional mandate of the census." And again, so that was Mayor Steve Benjamin from Columbia, South Carolina. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, she chairs the Conference of Mayors Census Task Force. She said, quote, "All deserve to be counted, and I'm pleased with the Supreme Court's ruling. The fight is not over, and we will continue to advocate for every single person to be counted in the census." And that's Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. It wasn't regionally specific. There was pretty uniform opposition to it. Mayors from border states were also on board. Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles, he was one of the most high-profile attendees of the conference. Also, Mayor Ron Nirenberg of San Antonio, Texas, another border city, opposed it. We reached out to Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell to see if he had any response to the ruling, and his office declined to comment on the matter. So we kind of heard what border communities feel, or their leaders at least feel, about the issue. I wanted to find out how Hawaii stands to be impacted by the census and a potential undercounting if this question were to be added. And I spoke with Eugene Tian. He's an economist with the State Department of Business and Economic Development and Tourism. He's also the governor's liaison to the Census Bureau. So he's sort of the head guy in Hawaii as it comes to census issues. And he told me that every aspect of public policy depends on census data.
The data are used by policymakers, state agencies, you know, government agencies, and even businesses for their business planning, for infrastructure planning. For example, we want to know how many public housing and how many schools to build, how many healthcare facilities need to be built, childcare, senior centers, even shopping malls and residential homes. All these planning depends on the census data.
And you can see that it really affects a lot more than just the accuracy of voting districts, which are very important in and of themselves. And it is, as Eugene said, used by every level of public policy, from local, state, federal, elected officials at all of those same levels use it to help fund drive their programs. And we use it here. In a lot of our reporting, we rely on census data as well. Interestingly, Hawaii has some of the highest rates of non-response. So by law, everyone in the country is required to be counted. So the Census Bureau sends out mailers first to try and get people to do it that way. There will also be an online way to respond this year for the first time. If you don't respond to that, they send people out to your house to knock on your door and try and get you to answer it, because they're required to get everybody. That includes people maybe living off the grid, people who are living in homeless communities. So it's a real challenge. And a lot of authorities were concerned about a potential added pressure of this question to discourage response. A lot of that concern was centered around areas with large immigrant populations, particularly Hispanic communities. But it would affect Hawaii as well, according to Colin Moore. He's the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Hawaii.
Oahu has a fairly significant non-citizen population, some who are here legally, some who are here illegally. But the point of the census is to get an accurate count of how many people are actually where they are and how many people are there. So we'll have the same effect here, which is that we suspect that the non-citizens will be less likely. That is potentially bad for the state. I mean, I don't think it means we're going to lose a congressional district, almost certainly not. But it still means that there's going to be more people in the state than potentially might be counted by the census because of this.
And Colin said that it's typically some of the most disadvantaged populations have the lowest rates of response. So the people who kind of stand to be most helped by what the census is trying to do, a lot of concern that the citizenship question would just exacerbate it. But for the time being, it looks like the question will not be included. The Supreme Court found, as we said earlier, that the administration's justification for this adding the question was inadequate. Pretty interestingly, the paper forms were scheduled to start printing today. The company that's supposed to do it is kind of on standby. They've been given two versions, one with the question, one without, and they're waiting for the go-ahead.
Right.
The Census Bureau has said at the absolute latest, it could push it back into the fall and still find a way to get it done. The printing company has kind of pushed back against that, saying you can only print so fast, and they're concerned about
right.
that.
And I know the president said, yeah, let's delay the census, and that's a big concern. You know, there's this fear factor
right.
if that question appears on there.
And that's never been done before, a delay like that. The census is required to be done every 10 years. The actual specific day has changed over the country's history, but we've never had a a delay like this before. Not clear if that's even legal. The Supreme Court decision was somewhat vague in the language. It just said the reasoning wasn't adequate, so that left open some kind of potential for a more adequate reason to be generated. We'll see what happens.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Ryan.
Sure.
That was HBR's Ryan Finnerty, who sat in on a session at the U.S. Mayor's Conference this weekend talking about the census controversy. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Have you been feeling old lately? Well, you're not alone. For today's quiz, we're giving a shout-out to all of our octogenarians. Hawaii's resident population has the highest life expectancy of all 50 states, and those born in 2015 will live to be, on the average, 81.3 years old, about 3 years longer than the national average. Not impressive enough? Well, Hawaii ranks number 2 among U.S. states in our centenarian population. 306 of our residents listed their age as over 100 years old in the last census. But it doesn't stop there. The Gerontology Research Group officially recognized one super centenarian from Hawaii. This resident lived to be a whopping 113 years old and was alive during the last years of the independent Hawaiian kingdom through annexation and when Hawaii became the 50th state of the union. For today's quiz, we want to know who was Hawaii's oldest resident. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Hello, it's me, President Trump.
And me, Bernie Sanders.
And there's only one thing that we agree on, and that's that everyone should listen to the Capitol Steps July 4th radio show. It is going to be stupendous.
I haven't heard a radio show this funny since my good friend Thomas Alva Edison told me about wireless transmission.
And I'm going to be singing many patriotic songs, and I know all the words, believe me.
So tune in to the Capitol Steps 4th of July special right here on this public radio station.
Thursday morning at 11. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Last week was quite a week at federal court as a jury handed down guilty verdicts for two main players, former police chief Louis Kealoha and his deputy city prosecutor wife Catherine Kealoha. Alexander Silbert is the first deputy federal public defender who convinced the FBI to take on the case years ago. He joined us in the studio earlier this morning.
The speed of the verdict surprised us all because it was very complicated in terms of the jury instructions, understanding the conspiracy law. The verdict forms themselves were many, many pages. So given the number of defendants involved and the number of verdicts that they had to reach, coming back so quickly surprised all of us. It was a little bit nerve-wracking because it's a question of, did the jury really understand the instructions and understand the verdict forms and how to fill them out? So we were all a little bit concerned about the speed of the verdict and did it show that the jury understood or not? But obviously, I believe that given the outcome, which is a split verdict, and what I mean by that is all the charges against Mr. Shiraishi were, they found them not guilty, whereas they found all the other defendants guilty, means that they really did deliberate and did take their time to parse out each defendant and what they were responsible for. So I think in the end, what we saw was a very well thought out verdict by this jury.
And, you know, there is still the appeal process. So can you talk to what that will look like?
So an appeal is filed 14 days after sentencing. You can't file before that. So in a trial, in any trial that a defendant has, it's a matter of right to appeal to a higher court, in this case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sitting in San Francisco. So this is a matter of right, and it's a matter of course. Any defendant will take this appeal. So this, they will file an appeal. And that process takes about a year once they file the appeal, because there has to be written briefs filed to the Ninth Circuit by all parties, and then oral argument, and then a decision by the Ninth Circuit. So the appellate process in all could take a year to 2 years.
Okay, and that's after sentencing, which is?
In October. But those sentences, you know, the dates of October may or may not be continued for some of them, because both Catherine Kailoa and Louis Kailoa have another trial to go through. She's got two more. There may be moves to continue her sentencing to get all those trials done. Same thing for Louis Kailoa. And then the other defendants may not want to be sentenced until the dust is completely settled. So things could be delayed even further.
What about those upcoming trials?
Well, the next trial is the fraud trial involving Louis Kailoa and Catherine Kailoa. And that's really a paper case. And as has been said by other commentators before, very difficult to defend against a paper case, because it's just the paperwork that you filed mostly with a bank or to some other institution. Your handwriting's there. Your signature's there. That's very difficult to defend if you can show that that was fraud. Then the third trial is the drug trial related to Catherine Kailoa's attempt allegedly to cover up for her brother, who was a doctor, and his prescription of opioids.
So how soon could that second trial start?
It's scheduled for October. I don't see any reason at this point why that would be continued. But I would think that the selection of a jury is even going to be more complicated for that trial, given the publicity and the outcome of this trial. So we all heard about this trial being the first day being conducted at the Blaisdell with 400 potential jurors. I would think that the next trial is even going to be harder.
Okay, so it might be at the Blaisdell again?
Maybe the Blaisdell, or they may need to go to UH instead, Sheriff's Center. Yeah.
And the third trial, has there been a date set for that?
I believe there's been a date, but I'm not aware of it. It's definitely towards the end of the year.
There's been some thought that it's going to be harder for her to mount a defense, given that the judge put her in jail the day after the jury came down with their verdict.
What people, I think, are saying about that is it's harder to prepare a defense when your client's in custody. And that's normally true, in the sense of it's much easier to communicate with your client and to look for witnesses and to talk back and forth if a defendant is out and you can meet with them regularly. It becomes a little bit more difficult when you have to go to FTC every time you want to talk to your client. But in this case has been hanging around for a long time. I'm sure she's been discussing this case with her lawyer for a long time. And it's a paper case. It's not like you're searching for witnesses. So I don't think her being in custody is really going to impact at all her ability to present a defense if she has one.
What about her mental state? Because that became an issue, and there was some discovery, I guess, during this trial.
She, of course, raised it early on to try to delay the case. I know in my particular case in 2014, there were issues related to her mental competency that came up. Judge Kobayashi has recently released and unsealed some of the pleadings in that case that had been filed under seal, which including a note from her doctor, Dr. Ito, regarding her mental competency back then. And this is back when she was making statements to HPD and to the postal inspector. There's a doctor's note saying she was mentally incompetent, legally mentally incompetent, to give depositions, to answer questions, to perform everyday work function. And that raised then, and it raises now, a serious question as to if she was mentally incompetent and found that way by a doctor, how could she be working? During that period of time, she indicted that huge gambling case, which everybody knows about and which was ultimately dismissed, and which then now there's a civil lawsuit. So that raises significant issues as to her competency and what she was doing as a prosecutor, and whether the prosecutor's office knew that and the impact that may have not only on the civil lawsuit in the gambling case, but other cases she handled.
Right, because you can't use that as an excuse not to be deposed and yet be handling all these high-profile cases at the same time.
Absolutely. And if the prosecutor's office knew that, which I assume they must have, and yet they allowed her to work and to indict people, it's not only a problem for the cases she handled, it's going to be a problem for the prosecutor's office in terms of how could they let that happen. I said a long time ago that I thought that Chief Kealoha threw my trial by deliberately making a misstatement, in which in fact he was in part found guilty of in this case. And part of that was because I was going to be able to cross-examine Catherine Kealoha on this issue of mental competency. Both Catherine and Chief Kealoha knew that going into the trial. So that was part of my reason way back then of saying I believe that the chief intentionally created a mistrial so that I would not have that opportunity and not make that public.
When we sat down before this trial started, we had talked about, you know, we were in uncharted territory. The fact that, we had to have an outside entity come in to get to the bottom of this, you know, I think speaks volumes.
In the sense that the federal system worked and did its oversight over state functions, which is part of what the federal government does and is supposed to do. So in that sense, it did work. It took many years to get here, but it did ultimately work. And the real question is, what do we do now to bolster and correct the state system to make it so that this doesn't happen again, that we don't need the federal system to step in, that the state system or the city and county system can create institutions that are powerful enough and strong enough and independent enough to provide proper oversight so we don't have to wait years and years and years and hope a federal government steps in.
And this case did cast a long shadow even over the Ethics Commission and some of the actions that they took, in particular with the executive director there, Chuck Tato, and Letha Dekaris, the investigator.
Right. The two unsung heroes here and the two people who still to this day have been hurt the most besides Florence Puana and my client Gerard Puana are Chuck Tato and Letha Dekaris because they both lost their jobs and were somewhat humiliated in the sense that the way they were dismissed for doing nothing but trying to do their job and to investigate very powerful people. And because they were doing it at a time where no one really believed anything that they were saying or anything that we were saying on behalf of the Puanas, they lost their jobs, and I think it's taken a heavy toll on both of them. It was very difficult to get people to believe what we were saying and what the Puanas were saying and what the Ethics Commission was investigating. People just didn't want to hear it, and they didn't want to believe it. I know back when this investigation was just beginning, there were many people in government who didn't want to comment or wouldn't take a position or basically said, let's just move on, especially when the chief was resigned, and really didn't want to delve into it. And I think this verdict and the information that was heard from the witness stand from many, many different witnesses really has opened up people's eyes. And I'm really hopeful that this will create some meaningful change in state government so that something like this doesn't happen again.
Right. And all the way down, the police department, the ethics commission, the police commission, you know, we've seen some changes, but you want it to be lasting.
We've seen changes. I think the changes were forced. The appointment of Loretta Sheehan and Mr. Levinson, Supreme Court Justice Levinson, was forced because it was obvious that the police commission wasn't doing its job. So steps were taken to bolster that. I'm worried about backsliding on the police commission because subsequently other people who were appointed don't have the background or expertise that Loretta Sheehan has or Mr. Levinson. So I'm a little worried what's going to happen to the police commission if we let it slip back to the way it was. I'm very concerned about the ethics commission because it really has never recovered from what happened back when Mr. Tato was fired. And so there have been changes. Susan Ballard seems to be a very good police chief and really trying to clean house and make it a very professional police force again. These are all steps in the right direction, but more needs to be done.
And you've been in contact with the Paunas?
I have. On the day the verdict came in, I was speaking to Gerard Pawana. He was speechless, very emotional, crying, could barely speak. You know, you have to remember, for him, you know, for 6 years of the of his life, he has not been believed. He's been ridiculed. His neighbors, you know, don't talk to him sometimes. So for him, this has been a very big moment in his life. And they had problems in their own family. There were family members who didn't believe him and sided with Catherine because they were all one family. So for Gerard Pawana, it was very emotional. I know for Florence Pawana, it was very emotional. She's very ill. It was great that the prosecuting team, Mr. Wheat and the FBI agents, all went to her house where she's staying and met with her and gave her a copy of the verdict forms. That was very generous of them, very honorable. It was great to see that. And I think she really appreciated it. You could see she really perked up from what the family said and was very alert and awake and responsive. And that was great that that happened. So I'm very happy for the Pawanas about the verdict, and I hope they can move on now.
Right. So this isn't the end. This is really kind of the beginning.
There's a lot more to come. We still have to find out what's going to happen with the target letters from Mr. Conachero and Donna Leong. There may be other charges coming against other individuals. Catherine Kailoa has not yet been charged with the obstruction counts involving her alleged ex-boyfriend and the Titos, because they've already pled guilty and admitted that she obstructed justice through them in the grand jury. Those charges haven't been filed. So there's lots more to come.
And the Titos, for listeners who may not know all the details.
The Titos were, they had a trust fund that was being overseen by Catherine Kailoa, and that money was all spent and taken allegedly by Catherine Kailoa. Then she got the Titos allegedly to lie to the grand jury on her behalf. One of the Titos, the older brother, has already pled guilty, saying that she got him to lie to the grand jury and that all the money was spent by Catherine Kailoa.
So much more to come. And we will be sitting down with Loretta Sheehan also to talk about what happens with the severance payout theoretically could be called back because now that there is a conviction against the chief. So much more to come.
Much more to come.
But thank you very much for sitting down with us.
You're welcome.
That was Federal Public Defender Alexander Silbert talking about what happens now that there's a verdict in the Hawaii public corruption case involving the Kealohas and several former police officers.
Aloha, I'm Paul Cianfrido from Mental Health America. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for a reality check with Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Brittany Light takes a look at the state's assisted suicide law and is on the line with us. Morning, Brittany.
Good morning.
So you had a really interesting story about a former fire chief, a battalion chief on the Big Island.
I did. Steve Johnson, he is actually the second person in the state of Hawaii to end his life using our brand new medical aid in dying law, also known as assisted suicide. Hawaii became the seventh state to allow this as a method of end-of-life care for terminally ill patients on January 1st.
And so I guess, you know, We all saw the fanfare when this bill was signed into law, but then when you actually put a face on the people who did ask to be able to control the end of their lives.
Yeah, so I think the state knew that there were going to be some hiccups in rolling this out, and there were. For example, when the law first rolled out, there were no pharmacies in Hawaii that were certified and willing to make the compound medication that's used for assisted suicide in this state. So that was definitely a hiccup, and it's something that we've gotten past. There's now three pharmacies in Hawaii that will make this medication. And so people are starting to use it. And I'm told by folks who monitor how other states have implemented this law that Hawaii is actually doing pretty well compared to other states. At the six-month point, we're doing okay. For example, when Washington, D.C. rolled out their medical aid in dying law, no one was able to access it in the first year.
Wow, a whole year.
Yeah.
And so what have been the other stumbling blocks, I guess, for rolling this out in Hawaii?
Well, for one, some doctors, hospitals, hospice organizations, they are opposed to the law. You know, there are religious and moral reasons why some people don't agree with this law. And there are protections in the law that allow people who oppose it to not have to participate. So one hurdle is that if your doctor doesn't want to participate in this law, your doctor doesn't have to let you know that this is an option that you now have for end-of-life care. Even if your doctor does want to participate, if that doctor works for a hospital, for example, that is outlawing this practice, then you're probably not going to find out about it from your doctor. So there's a big burden on the patient to become educated about this on their own and seek out a doctor who is willing and wants to work with them.
And your story talks about the situation at Kaiser, where there have been a number of requests.
Yes, Kaiser in Hawaii has set up a pretty robust system to deal with requests for medical aid in dying. I think they've got about five or six people on board. They've trained their staff to know how to handle these requests. They've got what's called navigators, which are they have a nurse and a social worker who work with families every step of the way. The woman I spoke to, the widow of someone who did end their life this way, said that the navigator for Kaiser called them every day at home just to check in on how things are going. So they're very, very involved. And I'm told by folks at the state health department that if you have a different insurance plan, it might not go so smoothly for you, at least not at this point.
Well, I certainly appreciated kind of the step-by-step process that you took us through in your story. And again, putting the face on, someone on that list, someone, who was probably very well known in Kona.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And I guess then we'll probably see more stories as we go through the year and more people get on that list.
Yeah, the state is monitoring this closely. At the end of the year, when we've had this law for a full year, they are planning to make some recommendations to the legislature about any potential changes we might need just to make this happen more smoothly for patients who want to access it.
Okay. All right. Well, we certainly appreciate you putting light on this and, again, putting faces to the names following the passage of this law. Thanks so much, Brittany.
Thank you.
That was reporter Brittany Light with today's Reality Check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Postpartum depression occurs in one of every 10 pregnancies on average. What can be done to help identify and treat this condition early on? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show when we talk with an expert about the options available for women who are affected by more than just the baby blues. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Aloha, I'm Howard Higa, president of the CAB, and the CAB underwrites Hawaii Public Radio. I am a director, treasurer, and proud sponsor of Hawaii Public Radio. All of us are enthusiastic and are committed to maintaining the best news, music, and conversation on this planet. As listeners and members, you have heard and seen the tremendous growth and coverage HPR has accomplished, and we look forward to seeing the future that HPR will bring. A big mahalo.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
For today's quiz, we asked you to tell us the name of Hawaii's oldest resident. This individual outlived two husbands and beat cancer twice, raised five children and many more grandchildren, proving it's never too late to try something new. She also hiked Diamond Head for the first time at age 100. Ito Kono Kinase of Kaneohe was 113 years old when she passed away in January 2003. At the time of her death, she was the sixth oldest person in the United States. In an interview with the Honolulu Star-Advertiser a few months prior to her death, Kinase said, "I can't believe I'm that old." I'm sure that sentiment is shared by many. We had no winners. No one got that one. We stumped you on that question today. But that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. To help deal with the doctor shortage, Kaiser Permanente has officially teamed up with the University of Hawaii John Burns School of Medicine to become a teaching partner. Today, it pledged $800,000 in scholarships for five incoming medical students. It's a long road to becoming a doctor in the U.S. You may not know that across the country, thousands of medical students are starting their residency today at hospitals that they were matched up with earlier this spring. This morning, we talked with UH's Director of Graduate Medical Education, Dr. Lee Wenkunseho-Lam, about the efforts to grow our pool of doctors.
We are happy to, you know, report that from the University of Hawaii, of course, we graduated over 70 students this past May, and they all begin their residency training across the country today. And about a third of them have stayed here in Hawaii. And so, you know, patients and staff and families will be seeing, you know, a new crop of resident physicians. But we also have fellows. So for us, we have about 80 in total new residents or fellows starting in our different hospitals and health systems. And our programs include programs in family medicine, internal medicine, OBGYN, orthopedics, pathology, pediatrics, psychiatry, surgery. But we also have fellowships in addiction psychiatry, a new one in addiction medicine, which is highly needed, cardiovascular disease or cardiology. And we have fellowships in geriatrics, child and adolescent psychiatry, maternal fetal medicine, which is the high-risk OB, and also complex family planning, as well as neonatology, sports medicine, and surgical critical care. So our fellowships are, you know, and our programs are really designed to help meet the needs for Hawaii and to train physicians, you know, that where hopefully they will return. If they go on for fellowship, they'll return back to Hawaii, or, you know, they will stay. So all of our programs do a good job of making sure to select our residents and fellows that really do have a commitment to take care for our diverse patient population and to really help address some of the different health challenges and health disparities that exist in many of our populations.
Now, I know we were talking to a number of hospital administrators, and I think one of them had mentioned that I think we've got a shortage of, it's like 400 doctors a year or something to that effect.
Yeah, actually, it depending on how you slice the data, the number actually ranges in the 500 to 700. Depending on, it's worse on neighbor islands and worse in certain specialties. But there, yes, overall, there is a shortage. There's a high need for primary care throughout the state, and whether that's internal medicine or family medicine. Pediatrics is also a primary care specialty. There's a need for mental health providers. Psychiatrists are really at a huge shortage area in the neighbor islands, and in particular, child psychiatry.
So really, that 400 number is conservative.
Yes. Yep.
And let's talk about the neighbor islands, because, you know, I recall, you know, at one time there hearing from somebody that, gosh, you got to pray that you don't break your arm and end up in the ER on the Big Island, because they didn't have a, you know, orthopedic surgeon there in the ER to be able to handle that. And likely you would be sent over to Honolulu.
Yeah, so luckily that part has been resolved, but it is still a high need area. You know, we know from the physicians workforce studies that our medical school does every year that many of the physicians are getting older. But there are some specialties that actually, so endocrinology, which is kind of the hormones, really, really complex diabetes, thyroid, you know, those would be cared for by an endocrinologist. Rheumatologist, which are folks that take care of the very complicated rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or other connective tissue disorder patients, even lung specialists, pulmonologists. They will often fly from Honolulu to the neighbor islands and provide care there, you know, once or twice a month, depending on the need. But increasingly, telehealth is being utilized, which is great. And for some of the, for actually many of the conditions, even for surgery, telemedicine is really a growing opportunity. So for surgery, obviously, you need to, you know, have a surgeon do the actual surgery. But before the visit, things could be planned and, you know, good discussions with the primary care physician on the neighbor island to make sure that everything is optimized and ideal, so that then if the patient does have to be flown to Honolulu for surgery, and usually these would be a much more complicated surgery or, you know, say a surgery with someone has cancer, for example. Those would likely need to be done in Honolulu, or a pediatric surgery would need to be done in Honolulu. But the surgeons are starting and really wanting to do more telemedicine with the neighbor island providers before, and that again helps to optimize the outcomes of the surgery, and then certainly for afterwards follow up, a lot can be done. So whereas, you know, 5 years ago, folks would have to really fly to Oahu and stay on Oahu for quite a long time. Now with the advent of telemedicine, some of those times will be a little bit less.
And what are we doing to encourage more of our young people to get into medicine? Because the time, you know, which it's a long road, you know, to get to be a doctor, and the cost is staggering.
Sure. Sure. So there are what we call pipeline programs, which really start in the elementary schools in some areas, and definitely in the middle schools and the high schools. So the first thing is really to try to encourage children to go into STEM fields, or the science, technology, engineering, and math. So that's collectively called STEM. And so there's a lot of programs done not only by the medical school, but by other partners within the University of Hawaii to really try to improve, you know, STEM education, and then in the there are some specific outreach programs that our medical school and medical students do to some of the intermediate schools and some of the high schools. We work with the health academies, which are now increasing in popularity in many of our public schools. And there are numerous opportunities in the summer for students to come to the medical school and do get a, you know, know, short, like 1 week or 2 week experience, various different things. Our health system partners offer summer experiences as well for folks that are interested in medicine. And importantly is also the mentoring and the mentoring piece. And so for high school students and even for college students, you know, having great grades is not the only criteria, right? There's a lot of other things that make one competitive for medical school, including do they really have an idea of what the field of medicine is like? You know, have they had the opportunity to shadow or to work in a hospital or work in a physician's office? You know, are they community-minded? Are they, you know, collaborators? Do they have that human touch and that human element, which is so very important? Can they think in teams? Things like that. So those experiences are really important to have. And so we do have guidance and mentoring set up for those students that are interested in health careers as well as medicine.
And you are encouraging a lot of the Native Hawaiians.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, there are specific programs for Native Hawaiian students and schools with large populations of Native Hawaiians. But many of our programs actually are targeting schools out in Leeward Oahu as well. And so really many of our populations that have more minority, ethnic minority populations, because we know we have an overall shortage of physicians, but when you look at the breakdown by ethnicity in comparison to Hawaii's population, we definitely do have shortage of Native Hawaiians and Filipino physicians and others, you know, and certainly with our many Asian subpopulations here, many of whom do not speak English as their primary language, then it's also important to, you know, see if we have students that are very interested in medicine and that are also able to speak another language, then that's, you know, obviously really great for patients.
I did have the opportunity to speak to one of your recent graduates at the medical school, and she came from the Philippines. Mm. And historically, we have tapped a lot of the medical personnel from the Philippines, whether they're nurses or aides, you know, because they do have a healthcare system, you know, they're in that country, and some of those hospitals are quite good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the care in many of the hospitals are really quite excellent. And so, I mean, we have students who speak one of several, you know, different dialects, which is huge. And while the great majority of residents and fellows are graduates of U.S. medical schools, there are opportunities for very highly qualified folks from international medical schools to apply.
That was Dr. Lee Wenkenseho Lum, a graduate medical education director as well as professor of family medicine and community health at the University of Hawaii Medical School. We have to go, but up tomorrow, we plan to sit down with the head of the Honolulu Police Commission to find out about what happens to Chief Kealoha's severance pay now that there's a verdict. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR. Or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Catch us tomorrow for more of the Conversation.